know how many objects are in the Kuiper Belt.
Is it dark energy? Please tell us.
There might have actually been another Neptune-sized planet in our solar system that got ejected.
Hello, welcome to the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, science journalist Izzy Clark, and with astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
This month, we're journeying beyond the outer planets, the Kuiper Belt, and exploring how it holds the secrets to our own solar system's formation.
So pack some snacks. It's going to be a long and rocky road trip. Plus, we'll be joined by an engineer from New Horizons to tell us about the mission that's seeing it all up close. So Robert Massey, he's here with us, the Deputy Director of the Royal Astronomical Society. How did the Kuiper Belt get its name? And I've noticed that I've said Kuiper Belt and Becky says Kuiper. So let's put that one
No, never listen to how I pronounce anything. I get everything wrong.
Well, the story is actually it was proposed as a concept before the discovery of Pluto by the American astronomer Frederick Leonard. And then the British astronomer Kenneth Edgeworth in, I think, about 1943, was someone again suggesting material in the early outer solar system that wouldn't have been close enough together to form planets, so would be left in a belt beyond Neptune. But the belt was named for the Dutch astronomer Gerard Kuiper, which is what I'm going with, who oddly didn't actually believe that any of that material would be left, because at the time he went with the general assumption that Pluto had about the mass of the Earth. It's actually a lot smaller, and it cleared away the material. So he didn't actually believe there would have been a Kuiper belt, and yet that's what it's named for. So there have been efforts over the years to call it the Edgeworth Kuiper belt, and some people will do that from time to time. And I think the International Astronomical Union even debated whether to make that name change, but didn't agree it. So most of the time we just stick with Kuiper belt because it's simple. But Edgeworth definitely deserves some credit as well.
I'm amazed that astronomers haven't tried to make it like the EKB yet, like not trying to make it into an acronym like we do with everything else. There is still time. There is, isn't there?
It's still time.
Cheers, Robert. We'll catch up with you later in the podcast when you help me take on some listener questions.
The Kuiper Belt itself is a sea of ice and rock at the edges of our solar system, just past Neptune. And it's essentially the leftovers from planet formation. These are the objects that had to come together first before everything else that followed, ranging from dwarf planets to icy blocks. I spoke with Dr. Meg Schwalm from Queen's University Belfast, who explained how the Kuiper Belt was formed.
The real way I think of the Kuiper Belt is kind of like the evidence left over at a crime scene, right? It's the fingerprints where you can see what happened, right? And you put it all together. So the idea being is that some of these objects we think formed in place. So these objects are telling us about planet formation and how do you take the primordial stuff that existed in the disk that formed our solar system, right? And how it formed little things that eventually grow into a planet but didn't. Other things that are in the Kuiper Belt were actually emplaced during Neptune's migration. And so they're actually from further in, including Pluto, and they got put out or dumped into this region as Neptune migrated.
So I think this is sort of one of those moments when we talk about our solar system's formation that you say, hang on, sorry, what? So talk us through this migration of Neptune. Are you saying that Neptune wasn't always where it is now?
Not only Neptune, all of the giant planets. And there might have actually been another Neptune-sized planet in our solar system that got ejected.
Wow. Okay.
Along the way. So we might not even have our full complement of giant and ice giant planets sitting in our solar system that we did 3 billion years ago. And so it's really by studying the orbits and the properties of the Kuiper Belt, as well as the asteroid belt, that astronomers have been able to put this story together.
Can you talk me through that? What was going on with our giant planets in the formation of the solar system that we know today? How has that changed?
So we think that the giant planets, so Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and maybe this extra Neptune, were sitting in a very tight configuration. And so the remnants of things that didn't form into another giant planet were sitting on the outside of all of these planets. And so occasionally stuff diffused in and they would sort of scatter around, kind of like one of those, you know, arcade games, right? Going around, bumping off the and scattering from off the planets gravitationally. And so the orbits will shift a little bit, but not very much. But over time, if you get enough of those, you might be able to nudge the planet's orbit just a little bit. And so Uranus, Neptune, and this extra ice giant were scattered outward. Eventually, the extra ice giant looks like it was scattered out of the solar system, and Jupiter moved inward. And so Pluto actually got caught up in this mess, and so it was minding its business right in this planetesimal disk and got swept up along with many other Kuiper Belt objects into the Kuiper Belt. And so actually, we can see some of these signatures. So we have these two really cool populations in the Kuiper Belt. Then we have those things that formed in place, plus all these things that were from further inward that tell us about the conditions there. So it's kind of cool that we get to study both of these populations and how they've been sort of mashed together by this reorganization of our solar system.
And so how do we know that this is what went down? You know, how are scientists like yourself trying to put that puzzle together?
Yeah, I think you never know for 100% certainty, which is what I love about science. It's by looking at both the orbital properties of these small bodies, their composition. So we see that it's sort of pointing to, hey, these look like two different things that were shoved together. And then we can also look at evidence in the asteroid belt that also helps to support that.
On that, can we talk about the properties of the objects that are in the Kuiper Belt? We've said that they're rocky or they're icy. What else do we know about them? You know, how big or how small can they get?
Yeah, so we study them by looking at their light, by how much they reflect back in optical or near infrared or even infrared light. So it tells us a lot about its properties, its surface properties. We can look at and see if there are absorptions from different types of ices or even the signs of silicates, you know, rocky material on these objects with spectroscopy. The one challenge is because these objects are so far away, it's only the very largest and brightest we've been able to get spectroscopy on. The largest of these, so the things that are round dwarf planets, which are about 1,000 kilometers in size, these things have methane on them, nitrogen, ice, things we thought were primordial that, you know, comets tend to have on their surfaces. We also see that they're all a little different. So the different dwarf planets called Pluto or Makemake or Eris, all these round worlds, right, they all have sort of different amounts of these volatile ices. And so they're each sort of their own laboratory, which is kind of cool. So even just thinking about in terms of planet formation, they're all telling us something slightly different. And these really large guys, these are sort of the stepping stone planet formation right before you get to forming sort of a core of a Neptune or a Jupiter. Then there's smaller things that are, you know, 100 meters, 500 meters. And those are things that build up to make sort of the dwarf planets.
And so for you, what are the future challenges or aims to understanding the Kuiper Belt that bit more?
Yeah, I think there's lots of really cool things I think that'll happen in the next decade. So, I mean, one thing that has happened recently is that, you know, we had a spacecraft that flew by Pluto. So we got the big object that was dumped into the Kuiper Belt and Arrokoth, which is a cool object that formed in place, right?
And so this is that object that people might have seen that was discovered, what, in 2019? And it looks a bit like a flattened snowman. That's essentially what it looks like.
I like to say it's two ravioli stuck together.
Okay, or that.
But flattened snowman works too. That's really cool, and that data is still being analyzed. So I think there's a wealth of data that's going to come from studying these things. These populations of objects in the Kuiper Belt and beyond are going to potentially tell us about whether there's a ninth planet, like a real giant planet kind of thing, orbiting, you know, way beyond. There are theories that suggest that based on sort of the very distant objects that are just sort of at the edge of the Kuiper Belt that might be due to the influence of a ninth planet. So I think is by studying more and looking for objects that are further out in the Kuiper Belt and beyond, we're going to be able to answer that question. And just in general, how did these things form? What did they look like initially in that initial disk before Neptune came through? And what does this tell you about how you form planets? For me, all of that stuff's going to be answered in different ways in the next decade or two or three when the Rubin Observatory turns itself online in 2023. So to me, that's going to be the really exciting survey on the horizon.
She's not wrong. That is going to be so exciting. That's Dr. Meg Schwarm from Queen's University Belfast.
Can I just say, Izzy, speaking of mispronouncing things, I don't think I've ever heard anyone say Makemake, like, out loud before. Like, I've been saying make this entire time, and I've just realized that's wrong.
Do you know what, when I was researching this, I was looking at it like make, oh, I've never heard of that before, and then I was like, Oh my gosh, it's Mako Mako. I'm so glad that you had that as well. I was like, I'm not going to admit to that, but you're a bigger person than I am.
Yeah, I'm an actual astronomer. I've been to Hawaii. I should know that it's Mako Mako, not Makemake. Anyway,
there are so many questions to unpack here. And can I just say now, we are going to be devoting next month's episode to Planet Nine. So before we get any messages saying we want more information, it is coming, I promise. So
yeah, it's my favorite topic. We couldn't have not talked about it.
Yeah, Becky and I have been like, when are we doing Planet Nine? We are doing Planet Nine next month, I promise. So Becky, do we know how many objects are in the Kuiper Belt?
Yes, kind of. So we've actually observed just over 2,000 objects in the Kuiper Belt, sort of in the very old-fashioned way of, you know, taking a picture, you've got the background stars, you've got anything that might be in the solar system, and then you take a picture, say, a week or a month later, and you look to see if anything's moved, and you can sort of figure out the distance and figure out if it's in the Kuiper Belt or not. But as you can imagine, those things are very faint. These little, you know, 100-kilometer clumps, you know, very far away. So we're pretty sure, in fact, we know that we've not found them all, right? It's not just 2,000 objects in the Kuiper Belt. No way. So the other thing that we actually detect is Kuiper Belt objects passing in front of stars. And they actually block out the light from stars very briefly. And so if you can sort of pick that out, then you can say, okay, well, like something like Kuiper Belt objects passed in front of it. And then from sort of an estimate of like how dense that is and how many stars there are, what are the chances that that might happen? And then you can get an estimate of how many of those much smaller objects that you don't see with a telescope, that you don't see with light, exist as well. And you've got an idea of, okay, here's the distribution of sizes of things in the Kuiper Belt. And then we know the mass of the Kuiper Belt because we know how much it affects the other planets in the solar system, right? And so we can estimate that actually quite small. I looked up this mass, and to be honest, I would have got it way, way wrong. It's only about 2% of the mass of the Earth.
Oh.
So there's really not a lot of stuff out there. But because they're obviously only like 100-kilometer sized chunks, even with 2% of the mass of the Earth, and so we estimate that number to be around about 100,000 objects, at least over 100 kilometers wide in that region of space. So I think it's just worth pointing out, like, even though we think of it as this sort of, you know, big asteroid field, there really isn't actually that much mass out beyond the orbit of Neptune.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I wouldn't have thought that. And this is far out. And I know that we haven't had many examples of these, but how do these objects compare to interstellar objects? You know, can they reveal anything about what's beyond our solar system?
I think eventually, yes, when we start to detect more of these interstellar objects, and we've had Oumuamua, definitely, we've had a second one as well, possibly, yeah. Because we do think that some of these Kuiper Belt objects will have been ejected from the Kuiper Belt in the lifetime of the solar system. You're going to, even though it is very sparse, there's still going to be interactions over 4.5 billion years, right? You wait long enough and eventually something will come along. You know, there'll be interactions or collisions, and that will send stuff flying out into interstellar space. So we think the same thing can happen around other stars in the Milky Way as well. It's going to start flinging stuff out like Oumuamua. So if we can compare sort of the composition of things in the Kuiper Belt and the composition of things that come flying through our solar system, then we can get some idea of the differences between different solar systems. And it'll all depend on what the gas cloud that solar system, that star system formed from in the first place. But that'll give us a really good idea of, well, are we unique or are we different in terms of what we formed from in the Milky Way or not? Or is it fairly uniform? So I think in the future, as we observe more and more of those things, then yes, but at the minute, probably not.
Right, okay. And then looking at planet formation, you know, what actually makes a planet rocky versus a gas giant? You know, how can we get the two different types of planets?
Yeah, yes. I mean, it's literally a case of whether the gas is there or not for you to form it into your planet. And if you think about closer into the sun, it's a lot hotter.
Yeah.
So any hydrogen gas or helium gas that really makes up the gas giant planets, right? It's the very light gases. That kind of gas is going to be, you know, hit by radiation from the sun, given a load of energy, the molecules are going to go crazy, right? And there's no way that you're going to be able to bring the molecules in that gas together and condense it down to form an atmosphere. It's just going to have too much energy. But further out from the sun, it's a lot colder. That gas is a lot more slow moving. So it's going to be pulled in by the gravity of objects forming out there, especially when those objects literally snowball, like the gas giants did, and collect all of that gas. So it's literally about whether that is there, but also about the size of the things that you form as well. In the Kuiper Belt, they're only 100 kilometers across, right? Their gravity is not strong enough to pull in that kind of hydrogen gas and then hold onto it as well. In January 2006, NASA launched New Horizons. It was a mission to study the dwarf planet Pluto, its moons, and other objects in the Kuiper Belt. Now, here we are in 2021, and it's way beyond Pluto, but it's still sending back data. Now, we're joined by Alice Bowman, Mission Operations Manager for New Horizons. So, Alice, can you talk us through this? Like, where is New Horizons now? How fast is it going?
Oh, goodness. Well, New Horizons is at 50 AU, astronomical units. So that equates to about 7.5 billion kilometers. Wow. So really far away. It's traveling at about 58,000 kilometers per hour.
Gosh, that is speedy. So how can New Horizons travel this distance? You said 50 AU. That's 50 times the distance from us to the sun. That is quite far away.
It is. And I think for the operations team, this really becomes real when we send instructions or commands to the spacecraft. And it takes almost 7 hours right now to get to the spacecraft. And then, of course, 7 hours more until we receive an acknowledgement from the spacecraft. So distances are huge. And again, we're sending these commands at basically the speed of light.
Gosh, wow. So what's powering New Horizons? You know, as we said, it launched in 2006. So how is it still going, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, that's
a very
good
question. Do you want to know its
secret? Yes, I need to know.
Yeah, good question. Because we're so very, very far from our sun, we can't use solar panels to gather power for the spacecraft. So this spacecraft is nuclear powered. As with all nuclear power sources, there's a decay that happens. So when we launched the spacecraft in 2006, our power was about 240 watts. And now we've traveled 15 years or so, and we are at about 182 watts. Of power. So we have to be very careful with managing that power.
Does that mean there's a projected lifetime then for New Horizons? Like eventually it will just have too little power to communicate back to us?
Exactly. The most power-hungry component on the spacecraft is the transmitter. And so we believe that the mid-2030s is at the point where we would not be able to turn and send data back to Earth. Although the spacecraft can go on and collect particle kind of data because the amount of power it takes to operate those instruments is much lower than the transmitter.
So it could hold loads of secrets and we might just never know about it. That's brilliant. So, you know, what has New Horizons found so far?
Oh my goodness. Have you seen the pictures of Pluto?
With the heart. That's my favorite thing.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. This heart-shaped glacier.
Exactly. And you know, when that heart showed up on our screens, it was like, here's Pluto in your face. You took so long for Earthlings to get there and see what I look like. And here you go. This is a big old heart. And it was astounding. So on Pluto, all those things that we found, the glacier fields, the water ice mountains, the methane frost, the atmosphere, there's about 12 layers of haze in the atmosphere. When we passed Pluto, we turned the spacecraft and looked back and had the sun lighting up the atmosphere of Pluto, and it was actually blue. Can you imagine that? Just like on Earth, although not quite as vibrant a blue as on Earth. Ice volcanoes, crevices. I think for me, it's mostly the diversity that Pluto has that was so surprising. And we only imaged one side of the planet. So I think we should go back and image the other side.
Yeah, who knows what's what could be on the other side. So I remember it was announced in March 2019 that the mission had actually been extended. And this was after it had been to Pluto, and it had also been past the Kuiper Belt object as well, the little snowman that we saw, right? So once it's been to both of these two sort of worlds and visited and sent data back, like what's its job now almost? Like what's it looking for?
Well, I have to say that we are still bringing back data that was collected at Arrokoth. Quite an interesting little snowman, if you will, kind of a flattened snowman. So we still are bringing down data, and we are imaging other Kuiper Belt objects, of course, not as close as we got to Arrokoth, but we've imaged over 30 Kuiper Belt objects, and we are actually searching for another Kuiper Belt object to fly by.
It must be incredibly dark. So how do you actually take photos with New Horizons?
Well, the cameras were built to operate in this very dark environment. I know it doesn't seem like a lot of light, but we can plan those observations so that we are looking at the sunlit side of those objects. And one of the other techniques that's used for these very, very dark, faint objects is to take many, many images, and then we call it stacking. We stack them up. And so with a lot of images, those faint points of light are brought up so that you can see them with your eye.
As mission operations manager, like you've been involved in this so closely, like do you have like a personal highlight that stands out to you from New Horizons?
Wow. Besides all the amazing pictures, images, and data that we've returned with New Horizons, I would have to say it was the July 4th anomaly. We were 3 days from starting our intense imaging of the Pluto system. So that was a 9-day imaging period. And July 4th was our opportunity to send this set of commands to the spacecraft. And during that process, we lost comm with the spacecraft, and it looked like the flyby imaging was in jeopardy because there was no way in the state that spacecraft was in that we could collect all this wonderful data. So I think that's what really stands out to me.
Yeah. the stress of that situation. So how did you get it back online? Like what happened?
Yeah, well, we have an amazing team, and we worked over the next couple of days. And on July 7th, the morning that this 9-day sequence was going to start, we saw the spacecraft had acknowledged all the commands that we sent, and it was in a state where it could accomplish the flyby.
I can't even deal with thinking about that kind of level of, like, I'm so impatient. And like, the idea that you would have to wait that long to find out if everything was okay and there's almost, like, nothing you could do. Like, I can understand why that stands out as a highlight to you, just overcoming that. And then the feeling of knowing that everything was okay at the end.
Yeah.
So just massively outweighed the stress before it. So what is next for New Horizons? What do you hope to see coming back? Can you tell us anything, or are you sort of sworn to secrecy?
No, not sworn to secrecy. Well, our scientists have been using the Subaru telescope, that is a Japanese telescope. It's out in Hawaii, to search for Kuiper Belt objects that might be in the path or near path of our spacecraft to do a close flyby. Also searching for objects that we could image. Once they find those objects, they use the Hubble Space Telescope to refine those orbits so that we can uplink them and build a command set for imaging. Coming up in May, just in a few weeks, we will be putting the spacecraft into what we call three-axis mode, or I call it picture-taking mode. And we're going to be imaging three of these Kuiper Belt objects that our scientists discovered last fall.
Thank you so much, Alice. That was an absolutely just fascinating insight to how, you know, space missions like this actually work. That was Alice Bowman, Mission Operations Manager for New Horizons at the John Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland. This is the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, and with science journalist Izzy Clark.
We'll keep going with the Kuiper Belt in a moment, but can we take a look at some recent science news? I mean, someone set off the new science alarm.
It's happening.
Scientists at the Large Hadron Collider near Geneva have spotted an unusual signal that may be the first hint of a new kind of physics. Becky, are we really looking at a potential fifth force of nature?
We could be, yeah. And it's not just this experiment at CERN either. There's been another experiment at Fermilab that they've just announced results as well, that completely separate experiment, completely different, also suggesting could be this fifth force of nature. So people are getting very excited, but we should rein in the excitement just a little bit. Because it's not quite that sort of level of statistical significance yet. We need to sort of start shouting it from the rooftops. But people are sort of starting to think this could be the case. So at CERN, what they were doing was they were smashing protons together in their big Large Hadron Collider, this big 27-kilometer-long tunnel they've got built under France and Switzerland. And essentially what they do in those collisions is they just see what pops out and see what happens, right? So one of the things you can create in those collisions is a bottom quark or a beauty quark. So if you know any particle physics, right, they have this thing called the standard model, which is all of the particles and all of the forces which govern those particles, except for gravity, which is general relativity, right? And with all of that model, you can essentially use those forces to predict how any particle will behave in any situation you can put it in, right? And then we do experiments that then we test whether the experiments give us the same thing as the model. And if they give us the same thing, we're like, great, our model's right. Pat on the back, gold star for us.
Woohoo.
In this experiment, they were looking at something called these bottom quarks, or beauty quarks, they're sometimes called. And what happens to these is they're very unstable. And they decay into either something called a meson, which is two quarks, plus an electron and a positron, which is its antiparticle, or a meson and a muon and an anti-muon pair.
Yeah.
Okay. So essentially there's two ways it can decay and be like, oh, no, I'm too heavy. I need to be something else. And they should happen at exactly the same rate.
Okay.
Given everything we know about forces in physics and everything, they should happen at the same rate. In this experiment, they found that the electrons were being produced way more than the muons. So one was happening more than the other. So there must be some other force that's interfering with it.
Ooh. Okay.
At Fermilab, they were trying to measure these muons. And they were trying to measure what happens to muons if you put them in a magnetic field. And all particles spin, right? But if you put it in a magnetic field, they start to wobble like a top. And again, the standard model predicts how much they should wobble. Lo and behold, the experiment measured a different amount of wobble that the standard model predicted. Again, suggesting there's some extra fifth force that's interfering with this thing.
Very exciting. Okay.
So, I mean, it's a bit of a long story to explain, I guess. But it's really exciting because there's two very different experiments suggesting a different force is interfering that we've never thought about before. And there's going to be some new physics. But the CERN experiment has a 1 in 1,000 chance of being a statistical fluke. And the Fermilab experiment has a 1 in 40,000 chance of being a statistical fluke. Now that might sound very high, but particle physicists, they're not like astronomers. We're like, 1 in 10,000, good, we're good to go. They're like,
that's fine.
We need a 1 in 3.5 million chance of a fluke before they start to accept anything, right?
Okay.
So these are like the first hints, but they're not there yet. So this is why they're probably going to be doing more experiments, trying to get more data. They're turning the LHC back on next year after a big upgrade to reach higher energies and more energy in the collisions. And so they're hoping that that will mean more of these decays and better statistics. And then we can finally shout from the rooftops like, there's our fifth force that we didn't think of.
The astronomers are there like, can we say it now?
Yeah, is it dark energy? Please tell us. Is it anything to do with dark matter? Have you finally did the one job that we set you?
Oh, that's so brilliant. Well, I guess we'll just have to keep an eye out. I think we say this every single episode. It's like, we'll just wait and see.
Yeah.
And we will continue to wait and see.
But you're allowed to be a minor level of excited.
Yeah, I'm gonna ring the science alarm. I was excited when I saw that headline. But I guess we should probably get back to the Kuiper Belt. So we have had a lot of questions. So thank you to everyone that sent them in. We didn't have time for all of them.
There were some good ones as well. I was reading through them like, yeah, there were loads. How are you going to pick?
And luckily, there were a couple of duplicates. I was like, great, everyone's happy. So Robert, can you take this one from Peter, who's in South Australia? And he asks, What is the largest object in the Kuiper Belt?
Well, effectively, Peter, it's Pluto, because Pluto is the kind of prototype Kuiper Belt object. It's another name given to them sometimes is exactly a trans-Neptunian object. And those of us who are old enough recall its demotion from being a proper planet to a dwarf planet about 16 years ago, which really, you know, was a trauma for those of us who grew up with nine planets, but we'll wait for the new planet nine to come along. So Pluto then is the biggest object in the Kuiper Belt, and it has a diameter of 2,377 kilometers, which incidentally makes it quite a lot smaller than our moon. But one of the objects in the Kuiper Belt in this region, the scattered disk out beyond the main belt, Eris, is only a tiny bit smaller, only about 50 kilometers smaller. So, and that's also given the category of being a dwarf planet. They're all very, very faint. I mean, you have to be quite an advanced amateur astronomer, for example, to see these things, but they are out there. And some of them, like Pluto and Eris, are quite big.
Why is it that Pluto did get named a dwarf planet and
reclassified,
fine, booted out?
Why did it get renamed? Well, this was a big controversy 16 years ago. So there was a lot of debate about and still is in some circles, about what constitutes a planet and what doesn't. And the definition, I think the thing that Pluto fell down on, so it has the right shape, it has to be round, it has to go round the sun rather than something else. So moons don't count. But the thing it lost out on was that it wasn't really big enough to clear the space around it. So the IAU, the International Astronomical Union, which decides these things, took the view that it would have to be a bit bigger and clearing space around it. So if you imagine something like Jupiter as it moves through the solar system in its orbit, it has a very strong influence on things around it. Pluto is just too small to do that. It's a lot smaller than our moon, so you can see why that's not going to happen. And that's what it's come down to. Most of us now, we sit there and say, yeah, it's a dwarf planet. It's Pluto. You know, it's something we've just sent New Horizons to a couple of years ago. Well, actually, it was 6 years ago now, wasn't it? But, you know, fantastic results on that. So let's just say it's Pluto and not worry too much about its designation.
Tell that to the internet.
Yeah, all I was going to say is I'm waiting for the tweets.
Everyone take it up with Robert. Don't mention it.
Maybe I'll go on Twitter for a couple of weeks.
Becky, how about this one? Why hasn't the Kuiper Belt objects formed their own planet instead of being, on what someone said here, a giant mess of dwarf planets and asteroids?
I love that. You're not a hot mess. You're a giant mess of planets and asteroids. That's Neptune's fault, really. So we think it's Neptune's fault. So Neptune is big, especially compared to the Kuiper Belt, right? So remember before I said the Kuiper Belt is only 2% of the mass of the Earth. Neptune is 17 times heavier than Earth, right? So it is big and it has a huge influence on that Kuiper Belt, which is just beyond the orbit of Neptune, right? So anytime that any of those objects started clumping together, Neptune was just like, no, and would just drag them apart again and disrupt anything like that. It has a bigger gravitational pull than any of like two objects do like between them, essentially. So it can always disrupt that, hence why you just end up with this huge big giant mess of dwarf planets and asteroids, right? In the exact same way that Jupiter does to the asteroid belt as well, right? You could ask the same question about the asteroid belt. Jupiter's the one that's going nope in that case as well.
Perfect. Okay, that makes sense. And Robert, Sean Chesman, Jack Prime, Steve Brown and more ask, is the Kuiper Belt separate and distinct from the Oort cloud? So can we just start with, what's the Oort cloud?
What's the Oort cloud? Right, yeah, well, both the Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud were hypothesized as sources for comets. So when you get, for example, when you think of Neowise last year, which was that beautiful bright comet we had in the summer after several ones that didn't really come to anything, it's a long period comet. And what that means is it's come from a very, very great distance from the sun. And the hypothesis, because we can't see them when they're at this huge distance, is that there is this big reservoir, this big sphere of comets called the Oort cloud. And it's, you know, anything between 2,000 times as far away from the sun as the Earth is and 100,000 times, which is getting on for a quarter of the distance of the nearest star, a really, really enormous distance, way, way out from the sun. And that's the Oort cloud. So that was proposed by Jan Oort, I think, in around the 1950s. And whereas the Kuiper Belt is much closer in, so really you're talking between about 30 and 50 times as far away from the sun as the Earth is, so 4.5 to about 8 billion kilometers away. Still a huge distance, but nothing like as far as the Oort cloud. And the Kuiper Belt has a sort of donut shape because it's close, I guess, because it's close enough and associated with the formation of the solar system that if you imagine the planets in the solar system forming from a rotating disk of material, well, the Kuiper Belt objects were within that, so they follow the same kind of paths, whereas in the Oort cloud, they're all over the place. And some of those might have been scattered out from the early solar system, you know, and just ended up in random orbits, which is actually why when you see bright comets like Neowise, they can appear anywhere in the sky. The planets, the sun, the moon generally appear in the zodiacs in a belt around the sky, but comets can be anywhere. And that's because they're coming from the Oort cloud and because it's a big sphere shape.
Right. Well, I hope that clears that one up. And Becky Ankitsina and Michael Dempster want to know, does the Kuiper Belt create an obstacle while taking pictures of deep space through a telescope? And could any of these objects reach Earth?
So no, not really. They don't really provide any sort of obstacle to us. First of all, they're very faint, right? You know, even if you're taking an, you know, 3 hour long exposure of a distant galaxy or something, like, they're not going to be brighter than any star in that field. So foreground stars in our own Milky Way are more of a nuisance than any object in the Kuiper Belt will be. Plus, you've got to remember how sparse this is. Like, we're selling 100,000 objects maybe that are over 100 kilometers wide. So I mean, imagine that in the space that they actually contain in that orbit beyond Neptune. It's huge, right? You know, you think about it in this sort of 3D way, they're incredibly sparse, so you're not going to come across that many as you're taking an image like that. And even if you did, and you happened to have a Kuiper Belt object in the foreground, like you would a foreground star, it would be so small as well. You'd really easily be able to mask it out, so it's not a big issue. I don't think I've ever come across a Kuiper Belt object getting in the way of my exposure. If I did, I'd be calling up like people like Meg Schwan that we talked to before, being like, hey, guess what, as an extra bonus in my image, I can give you an image of this, do you want it? And that's never happened, right? And we're waiting for the day, I'm sure Meg's waiting for the day that happens as well.
Yeah, because I think there is that idea of, if you see things like Star Wars or whatever, trying to dodge all of these objects, and like it's not quite as dense as films. Exactly. Right?
Yeah. It wouldn't look very good for a film if you're like, gotta pass through this asteroid belt. Well, that was easy.
Well, I hope that covers everyone's questions. And if you're listening and you want to send in a question, then do so. You can email podcast@ras.ac.uk or tweet at Royal Astrosoc and we'll take a look. So, Robert, what about some of the things that we can see this month? And in fact, the Royal Astronomical Society have been looking to the ground for something recently, haven't they?
We have. This is our vice president, Steve Miller, who is an emeritus professor. So he's retired and doing quirky things, as a lot of retired academics do. And one of the things he did was to put a question on Gardner's Question Time about what had happened to the moon trees. Now, the moon trees were grown from seeds that were taken around the moon by Apollo 14. That's what they did. It was, they took various things. And Stuart Rusa, the NASA astronaut, flew them in 1971, then gave them back to institutions in the US. And we think, so trees grew in the US. They were sycamore, and the lobelia pine was another species. And we think that some of them, maybe around 15, ended up in the UK. And some of them were used to grow trees here. But nobody really seems to know where they are or what happened to them. So what we're trying to do, and Steve is trying to find out, obviously, is what happened to these trees. So if you know about any of these trees, if you work in a museum, a science center, a garden, and you happen to know that you've got a moon tree, then do let us know, because it's an intriguing search and an intriguing piece of space history. These ones just flying in Apollo didn't really seem to have any impact on the way they grew or anything like that. So hopefully they've been labeled if they reach the ground. There is a more recent example. Tim Peake took some into space, but they, I think, were exposed to radiation, and that did affect their growth. But the ones that went to the moon seemed perfectly happy. So, yeah, if you've got a moon tree in your garden, do let us know. We'd love to see it.
Oh my God, I really hope that someone listening actually does, and they can help us in this search for moon trees. That's brilliant. And so what if we want to look to the skies? What else can we be keeping an eye out for this month?
To quote Becky, it's definitely toenail moon season. Yes. Because in the spring side, the sky, the crescent moon is really, really good to observe. So we've just gone through it in April when this is going out, but in May, you know, look towards the middle of the month, you'll see a fantastic crescent moon after sunset. It's just because the angle of the ecliptic, the path of the moon and the sun through the sky, is very good at this time of year for that. I should also mention, if you're a Muslim, it's the end of Ramadan, Eid al-Fitr. So, you know, wish people well in observing that if they want to mark it that way too. Mercury and Venus are coming back into the evening sky, and towards But basically, as you get into May, it should be possible to see both of those planets. Mercury is at its best around the middle of the month, and the two planets are really close together. So, you know, perhaps a photo op on the 28th of May.
Also, combining Toenail Moon and Mercury and Venus on the 14th of May, which is the day before my birthday, but fine. Venus, Mercury, the Toenail Moon, and Mars will all make one big line at sunset.
I think it's, yeah, if you've got a wide field camera, you know what you're doing, we'd really love to see those too.
Yeah, Mars will be really high compared to Venus and Mercury, but you should still be able to maybe get it if you've got a wide angle. So fingers crossed.
And please send in photos if you do manage to snap that. We would absolutely love to see it.
I love the Toenail Moon. They're my favorite.
Do you know, I was actually walking down the street the other day, saw a Toenail Moon, and was like, Toenail Moon! And I was like, what has Becky done? Like, this is your fault.
So many people complain to me, like, that's what I think of you now. I see that, and the first thing I think of is toenails rather than the majesty of the moon. And I was like, I'm sorry, it's just what it reminds me of.
And the final thing I was going to mention, is I thought this was an intriguing one, is it starts with a sort of cheesy rhyme. There's a way of finding stars from the plough's tail. You follow the arc down to the bright star Arcturus, and you speed on to Spica in Virgo, which is a bright zodiac constellation. And just beyond Virgo is Libra, another zodiac constellation. And in that grouping is a star called Zubanesh Shimali, which is supposed to look green to some people. Now, there's not a clear explanation for this, but it might well be an optical illusion. But I just thought, you know, this podcast, we should ask if anybody does see Beta Lyrae, this star, as green or not, because I would really like to know that. But it would be great if people report that.
Yeah, we should put like a Twitter poll up asking people to vote.
We'll have
like
to
next
see
month.
What our listeners think as well. Well, that's it for this month. I am so ready for May, because that means our episode all about the hunt for Planet Nine. Finally, I mean, it only took us 17 episodes to get there.
That would have been 17. How did we go 17 episodes without? I think we've just been teasing it for too long, haven't we, Izzy? Anyway, remember, if you try some astronomy at home, you should tweet us. It's at Royal Astrosoc on Twitter, or you can email your questions to podcast@ris.ac.uk, and we'll try and cover them next month for Planet Nine. Until then, though, happy stargazing.